Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
You know that feeling. You open your news feed and bam, just this tidal wave of stock market stuff, economic indicators, opinion.
Oh, yeah. Information overload.
Totally. It feels, well, impossible to know where to start if you actually want to build wealth, you know, intelligently.
Really does.
So that's what this deep dive is really all about. Cutting through all that noise.
Finding the signal.
Exactly. Think of this as your personal guide, helping you understand what actually matters for smart investing. Today, our focus is really equipping you with knowledge you can act on.
And it's interesting, isn't it? There's so much info out there, but the core principles,
yeah,
they sometimes get lost in that daily flood.
Huh.
Feeling overwhelmed is, yeah, a very common starting point.
It really is.
Yeah.
So to help us navigate, we're diving deep into Colin Nicholson's book, Building Wealth in the Stock Market.
Nicholson.
Right.
Now, this isn't just someone who's, you know, read a few finance books. He spent 40 years, four decades, actively investing and consistently beating the market. 40 years.
Yeah.
That's some serious time in the trenches. You see multiple cycles, refine things through actual practice.
Precisely. And his book, it's not some dense academic thing full of jargon.
No, not at all.
In fact, Dr. Alexander Elder, he's a well-respected trader himself. He calls it practical and an invaluable resource.
High price.
Yeah. It lays out a whole roadmap for investing, finding good companies, and crucially, managing risk.
That risk management piece is key.
And the beauty is he explains it really straightforwardly. Not a lot of complex financial terms. So our mission today, simple, extract the key wisdom from Nicholson's experience, give you a clearer understanding of building wealth in stocks without needing that advanced finance degree.
And stepping back, what Nicholson offers is, well, it's a framework, isn't it? A structure. For a lot of people, that's exactly what's missing when they try to jump into investing.
Okay, let's get into the core of his thinking then. One of the first big things he tackles is active versus passive investing.
A fundamental distinction.
Right. So he argues for an active strategy, meaning basically aiming to be fully invested in stocks during bull markets when things are generally going up.
And then?
And then moving entirely to cash when the market's falling in a bear market. He actually calls this market timing.
Which is a term that raises eyebrows for some people. But his active approach involves, well, making deliberate choices about being in or out, based on his read of the overall trend. Very different from passive.
Exactly. Passive investing, which many people know, is more about the long haul, right?
Mm-hmm. Buy and hold, typically.
The idea being that over time, markets tend to trend upwards. So maybe the best thing is just to buy a broad mix, like an index fund, and just hold on, regardless of the short-term ups and downs.
And there's a strong case for that. That long-term upward bias is real. Historically, you know, good economies, successful companies, they tend to recover and grow.
But Nicholson's active approach puts the priorities somewhere else, protecting your capital, especially when things go south.
Capital preserve.
Yeah. But he's realistic, too. He admits trying to time the market perfectly, that means making way more decisions.
And more decisions mean?
More chances to get it wrong. More potential for error.
Exactly. The potential rewards of active investing, maybe better growth, maybe more incomes, they look good, but they come with that extra burden, the challenge of making those timing calls correctly.
Okay, so another major area, the age-old debate, fundamental versus technical analysis.
Yes, the two main schools of thought.
So for anyone newer to this, fundamental analysis is about figuring out a company's real worth, its intrinsic value.
Right, looking under the hood.
Yeah, looking at profits, earnings, sales, management, you know, all those company-specific factors. The theory is the stock price will eventually catch up to this true value.
And Benjamin Graham, often called the father of security analysis, really laid the groundwork for this back in the 30s. So it's been around a while.
It has. What's fascinating, though, is that core assumption.
Which is?
That all the important info gets reflected in the price and that investors act rationally.
Ah, yes. The perfect information and rational actor ideas. Economists love debating those. There's definitely a link between company performance and long-term price, but perfect.
Yeah.
Rational? Maybe not always.
Definitely not always. Yeah. And let's be honest, wading through financial statements, it can be incredibly daunting.
Eyes glaze over pretty quickly for most people.
Even pros find it tedious sometimes. Nicholson gets this. He suggests that for individual investors like you, we don't need to get totally bogged down in every tiny detail.
A broad brush approach, he calls it.
Right. Like knowing a company's PE ratio, price to earnings, is 10 versus another at 20. That's a big difference, worth noting.
Significant, yeah.
But sweating whether it's 10 versus 11, he suggests for most of us, that level of precision probably isn't the best use of our time.
And that's such a practical point. The sheer effort for super detailed fundamental analysis. Mm-hmm. It might not always pay off enough for an individual. Focusing on the big differences, like he says, is just much more efficient.
Okay, so that's fundamentals. Then you've got technical analysis.
The other side of the coin.
This approach focuses purely on the stock's price history and how much is being traded, the volume. Basically, supply and demand in action on the charts.
Doesn't really care why the price is moving, just that it is moving. It assumes all the known info, fundamental or psychological, is already baked into that price.
Exactly. Technical analysts study past patterns, trends, volume, trying to figure out where the price might go next.
They're looking for clues in the market's own behavior.
And Nicholson, yeah, he's really clear here. He believes in using both.
Not picking sides?
Nope. He argues fundamental analysis helps you figure out what to buy, good value, strong growth potential. But technical analysis helps you figure out when to buy.
Getting the timing right.
Yeah, finding that opportune moment.
And that combination, it can be really powerful. Fundamentals identify sound companies. Technicals help find good entry points, improves returns, helps manage risk.
Okay, this next part, developing a winning investor mindset. I found this really insightful.
Ah, the psychology of it all. Crucial.
Nicholson argues that success isn't just about financial knowledge or hard work, even experience. The real difference is how successful investors think. It's about having better decision-making skills.
That's so often overlooked, isn't it?
Mm.
The mental game. Our own emotions, fear, greed, they can easily trip us up and wreck the best strategies.
And a key point he makes is about selling. He says successful investors watch the trend of a stock closely, often using charts.
Visualizing the trend, yeah.
And if that upward trend starts to break down, he says they sell, almost instinctively. That's the kind of discipline he thinks we should aim for.
Being able to detach emotionally, especially when something isn't working, and just cut the loss decisively, that's a hallmark of experienced players.
Mm-hmm.
Recognizing the trend has failed and acting to preserve capital. Essential.
He also hits on that common idea of playing with the market's money when you have profits.
Oh yeah, I've heard that one.
He argues really strongly against it. Profit isn't abstract. It's real money. Your money. You need to treat it just as seriously as your initial investment. That's such an important mental accounting point. If you see profits as somehow less real than your starting capital, you might take stupider risks.
Right. And give back those gains. Successful investors see all the capital as theirs, whether it's the initial stake or the profit.
Makes sense.
And he really pushes this idea of treating investing like a business.
Professional approach.
Yeah. Make rational decisions, separate from your ego or feelings.
Yeah.
Look, not every investment is going to be a winner. That's just reality.
Absolutely not.
The key is cutting your losses short on the ones that don't work out and letting your winners, well, letting them run.
Letting the winners grow.
Yeah.
He uses that example, right? Investor A versus investor B.
Yeah. Investor A has lots of small wins and losses, kind of churning. Investor B might have some losses too, but also a few big winners that drive the overall performance. He suggests Investor B's approach aiming for those significant wins while managing losses is more effective. Because returns often aren't symmetrical, are they? A few really good investments can make up for quite a few smaller losses.
Yeah.
That discipline, cut losses early. Let winners run, it's key to long-term success.
And that flows right into the absolute importance of capital preservation.
Job number one.
Nicholson stresses this is the number one goal. Protect your capital. He has this table in the book. It's really eye-opening.
Yeah.
Shows how much you need to gain just to recover from a loss.
The math is brutal.
It is. Like, if you lose 50%, you need 100% gain just to get back to even.
Wow.
It really hammers home why avoiding those big hits is so critical.
That table really shows the power of loss aversion, mathematically. The deeper the hole, the harder it is to climb out. It underscores why risk management, avoiding big drawdowns, has to be central.
Then he takes on the idea of the investment holy grail.
Ah, the magic formula seekers.
Exactly. The idea that some guru or secret system can predict every market move. He calls people claiming this purveyors of magical thinking.
Healthy skepticism advised.
Totally. He says if anyone claims they can reliably forecast the markets, you should run the other way. Instead of trying to predict the unpredictable, focus on improving your investment method, your process.
That's much more realistic. Trying to find certainty in an uncertain world is a classic beginner's trap. Nicholson's right focus on developing a sound process, adapting, not forecasting.
He says successful investors, they buy based on perceived opportunity, right? But then their main focus shifts to managing that investment, nurturing the winners, selling the losers quickly.
Active management post-purchase.
And he makes this interesting point too. Even top investors aren't constantly certain about everything.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they're always questioning their own views, considering alternatives. It's like a defense mechanism against overconfidence.
That makes sense. Intellectual humility is a form of risk management. Constantly questioning assumptions, staying open to being wrong. That's sophisticated thinking.
And finally, on mindset, he stresses that becoming a good investor takes time and effort and actual experience.
No get-rich-quick scheme here.
Definitely not. It's a skill you develop. He recommends constantly learning books, in-depth articles, and he strongly, strongly advises having a written investment plan.
Your anchor in the storm.
Exactly. An objective document you can go back to stop your emotions running wild when the market gets choppy. He's very clear. His plan in the book is a model for you to adapt to your own situation, your own goals.
Seeing investing as a skill that grows over time with effort and learning sets realistic expectations. And that plan, it's crucial for stopping those impulsive, fear or greed-driven mistakes.
Okay, mindset covered. Let's get into the core principles of Nicholson's actual investment plan.
The nuts and bolts.
His main goal, his target, is an average annual return of 12.5% on his capital.
Average being the key word.
Absolutely. He's quick to say this isn't guaranteed every year, some years less, hopefully some years more. The aim is consistent long-term growth, partly by, getting out or reducing exposure during downturns to protect that capital.
That target gives a clear benchmark, doesn't it? And the focus on consistency, even if gains are smaller sometimes, while avoiding big losses. It highlights that capital preservation priority again.
He explains his returns come from two places. One, the stocks going up in value capital growth after all transaction costs.
Brokerage fees, etc. Got it.
And two, dividends companies sharing profits with shareholders. He's Australian, so he also includes franking credits, which are basically tax credits on dividends there.
Ah, the Australian system. For listeners elsewhere, the key takeaway is understanding your local tax implications on dividends and gains.
Right. And he mentions he values his stocks every day at the closing price and meticulously tracks and deducts all those costs. Gets a true picture of performance.
That disciplined tracking is important. No fuzzy math. Gives a realistic assessment.
And here's a really key concept he brings up, the Pareto principle.
The 80-20 rule.
Yeah. Applied to investing, he suggests it often holds true. A small number of your investments will likely generate the vast majority of your profits.
That's a powerful observation. It really underlines why letting your winners run is so important. Don't cut your best performers off too early.
Now he shifts to risk management, and he stresses that while picking stocks gets a lot of attention, managing overall market risk is absolutely essential, but often doesn't get enough focus.
So true. Stock picking matters, of course, but the overall market tide lifts or sinks most boats, right? A solid strategy has to manage that broader market risk.
He breaks risk down a bit. First, specific risk. That's the risk tied to an individual company maybe running into trouble.
Company-specific problems. Makes sense.
Then there's liquidity risk. The risk you can't easily buy or sell the amount of stock you want at the price you want. He says liquidity is a bit subjective, depends on the stock and your needs.
Specific risk points to diversification, right? Don't put all eggs in one basket. And do your research on the company. Liquidity risk is more for smaller, thinly traded stocks where big orders can move the price against you.
But the real cornerstone of his risk strategy is how he handles market risk.
The big picture risk.
His approach is to actively adjust how much of his total capital is in stocks, based on how risky he thinks the overall market is.
So more stocks when risk seems low.
Exactly. And less when risk seems high. And crucially, he aims for 100% cash in a bear market.
Wow, fully out. That's proactive management of market exposure. It's all about protecting capital when the whole market looks like it's heading down, moving to safety.
And his main tool for judging that market risk, he uses Dow theory. Specifically, its analysis of bull and bear market phases.
Ah, Dow theory, classic.
According to the theory, both bull markets, rising prices, and bear markets, falling prices, tend to go through three distinct recognizable phases.
It's a framework based on history, investor psychology, economic fundamentals. Identifying those phases gives clues about optimism, pessimism, and the level of risk baked in.
So let's quickly outline them. Bull market. Phase one is reviving confidence, people thinking things are cheap.
After a downturn, usually, yeah.
Early birds. Phase two is better company earnings, more people jumping in, though maybe some dips along the way.
Wider participation, economy looking better.
And phase three, rampant speculation. People ignoring bad news, talking about a new paradigm to justify crazy high prices.
Euphoria sets in, risk gets ignored. Classic top signal sometimes.
And for a bear market, phase one is distribution. Smart money starts selling, but most people don't believe it yet. You might even see sharp rallies.
Denial phase. False hope rallies.
Phase two, earnings start falling. Valuations get more reasonable. The public loses interest.
Reality bites. Concern grows.
And phase three, distress selling. People forced to sell, prices get hammered way below fair value, often hits when unemployment peaks.
Panic, capitulation, forced selling, the point of maximum pessimism, often near the bottom.
He also mentions the Kopeck indicator.
Right, Kopeck.
As another tool, specifically to help spot potential buying opportunities near the bottom of a bear market. But he stresses, wait for the indicator to actually turn up.
Don't jump the gun.
Right, and then focus on buying individual stocks that are already starting to trend up.
Makes sense. Kopeck is a momentum indicator for long-term turns. Waiting for confirmation from the indicator and seeing positive price action in the stock reduces the risk of buying too early while it's still falling.
He also mentions secondary movements, you know, the corrections within a bull market or the rallies within a bear market.
The wiggles within the main trend.
Yeah, and trading ranges where things just move sideways for a while.
Understanding those helps interpret the price action in context. Is this just a pullback or is the main trend changing? Trading ranges can be consolidation before the next move, or maybe indecision before a reversal.
He comes back to this core idea. All investing is risk management, but market risk is often the biggest piece. He even shares his own experience.
Oh, yeah.
He significantly cut his stock exposure before the 87 crash. And again, in late 2006, early 2007, shows his market risk approach in action.
Wow. That's putting your money where your mouth is. Real-world examples of how managing that market exposure can save your bacon during rough times.
So, based on those Dow theory bull market phases, he has a strategy for how much capital to commit. Like, he typically reduces exposure in that speculative phase three.
Pulling back when things get frothy.
And he has a firm rule. Sell any stock that starts trending down clearly. Period.
No ifs, ands, or buts.
His thinking, you can always buy it back if it turns around, but selling stops the emotional attachment to losers and frees up capital for better opportunities.
It's just solid loss management discipline. Stops capital getting stuck in dead wood, allows you to redeploy it.
And the cornerstone for managing specific stock risk, his strict rule. Never risk more than 0.5%, 0.5% of your total capital on any single stock.
That's quite tight, 0.5%.
He stresses it's a rule, not a suggestion. It forces you to calculate your position size carefully for every single trade.
That's a powerful risk control. Even if one stock totally bombs, the damage to the overall portfolio is contained, very manageable.
He also warns against borrowing to invest leverage, especially in companies already loaded with debt.
Magnifies gains, but also losses.
Risky. Yeah.
And he has a flat rule against derivatives, futures, options, that sort of thing. Too much potential for amplified risk.
Keeps it simpler, less potential for explosive losses.
And he points out the risk in illiquid stocks, thinly traded ones. Hard to sell quickly or at the price you want.
Getting stuck in an illiquid position is no fun if you need to get out. Can lead to big slippage.
He's also specific about the types of companies he likes. Mainly fully paid ordinary shares of established Australian industrial and service businesses.
Stable, understandable businesses.
Generally avoids resource explorers, tech developers, startups, often even producing miners. Says they're more complex, more speculative.
Sticking to what he knows and understands well reduces complexity risk.
And his policy. Only buy stocks aiming for both dividends and capital growth. No short selling betting on prices falling.
Long only. Focused on quality businesses. It's a risk-averse approach, focusing on companies with a track record, aiming for that margin of safety.
Now, how does he actually pick them? It's that combo again. Fundamental and technical.
The integrated approach.
Fundamentals based on Benjamin Graham's sound companies, margin of safety. Then he uses technical analysis, these value and growth chart models, to find potential buy points before digging deeper into fundamentals.
Or sometimes the other way around.
Yeah, sometimes he might screen fundamentally first, then use technicals to pinpoint the entry.
So it allows him to find companies that look good financially and are showing positive price action.
Increases the odds, potentially.
He outlines two main approaches. Value investing. Finding undervalued stocks, potentially lower downside risk.
ING.
And growth investing. Focusing on companies with strongly rising earnings.
Buying growth momentum.
He even describes how these look on charts. The value model has phases like accumulation, markup, distribution, markdown.
The classic cycle.
While the growth model is more like a sustained uptrend with pauses, consolidation phases before heading higher again.
Different patterns for different types of fundamental stories. Useful visual guides.
He has a weekly routine. Uses charting software to screen for stocks fitting those value or growth patterns. Filtering the universe.
Then applies his fundamental checks to that shorter list. He likes the 52-week moving average, finds stocks consistently above it tend to grow better.
A simple trend filter.
His fundamental filter looks at P.E. ratios, dividend yields compared to market averages, stuff you can find in financial papers like the AFR. And he repeats his exclusion list. High debt, foreign stocks, trusts, preference shares, explorers, startups.
Having a systematic weekly process is key for consistency. Efficiently narrows down the options to those meeting his specific criteria, both technical and fundamental.
He also briefly mentions comparing bond yields to stock PE ratios.
Market valuation check.
Yeah, to get a sense if the overall market is pricey. He uses a risk premium concept, the extra return needed for stocks over safer bonds. And he warns, a low PE isn't always good news.
Could mean the market expects earnings to fall, right?
Exactly. It's not always a bargain. So after running these filters, he gets a hot list of potentials. Some look ready to buy soon. Others need to wait for their charts to improve.
Building a watch list. Patience is key.
Generally, he doesn't like selling a well-performing stock just to buy a new hot idea, especially if that new one already hit his stop loss before.
Avoids unnecessary churning.
But he will sell a stock that's underperforming his expectations to free up capital for something more promising on his list.
Tactical reallocation. Makes sense.
When he does buy, he looks for those upward breakouts from accumulation or consolidation, or buys during the markup phase. And he stresses, build the position in stages. Don't go all in at once.
Staged entry confirms the trend, reduces risk of buying right at a temporary peak. Disciplined.
And to protect capital when buying, he always sets a sell stop loss order below a significant recent low point on the chart.
Your safety net. Predefined exit if it goes wrong.
Automatically triggers a sale if the price drops that far, limiting the damage. He also uses trailing sell stops.
Oh, those are smart.
They move up automatically as the price rises, locking in profits, but still letting the stock run.
Protects gains while participating in further upside. Best of both worlds sometimes.
He even has guidelines for profit taking. Like, consider trimming if one stock becomes, say, 12% of your total capital.
Managing position concentration risk.
And a guideline for maybe getting back into a stock he sold if it makes a new high later. He mainly uses weekly charts for setting stops. Finds daily charts lead to too much short-term noise and speculation.
Weekly charts, smooth things out, focus on the bigger trend. Keeps him from overtrading.
He believes in letting profits run as long as the uptrend holds, even if it means a bigger tax bill eventually. Good problem to have.
Paying tax on a big gain? Yeah, that's a high-class problem. Shows the strategy is working.
He has that specific method for position sizing, always sticking to the 0.5% risk rule per stock. And he admits, look, sometimes you'll get stopped out and then the price just turns around and rallies without you.
Ouch, that happens.
It does. You have to accept it. Investing is an art, not a perfect science, he says.
Managing the frustration is part of the mental game.
And he advises keeping those sold stocks on your hot list. Review them. Maybe the uptrend resumes later.
Keep an eye on them, yeah. Doors aren't always closed forever.
He describes his charting templates, too. A 15-year monthly chart with a 12-month moving average. a weekly chart for the closer look, and a market index template, which includes that Kopeck indicator on the monthly view.
Consistent charting setup helps with systematic analysis, quick visual checks.
And he finishes by just reiterating those profit-taking and re-entry guidelines, which are also right there in the summary of his plan.
Pulling it all together.
So as we wrap up this deep dive into Nicholson's building wealth in the stock market, what are the maybe two or three big things that really stand out, especially for you listening, wanting that clear knowledge without the overwhelm?
Good question.
For me, one has to be that relentless focus on capital preservation.
Absolutely, number one.
That table showing how hard it is to recover from losses, that really sticks.
It does. It frames everything.
Yeah.
And his specific tools, the sell stops, the strict 0.5% risk rule, there are practical ways to actually do it, not just talk about it.
Yeah, that's a great point. Another one for me is the integrated approach, using both fundamental and technical analysis.
Not being dogmatic about one or the other.
Right. It's not either or. It's leveraging both to understand what to buy and, just as vital, when to buy it.
That's synergy, yeah. Understanding the business value and the market timing, it's a more complete picture, potentially much more effective.
And the third one for me, that whole section on the winning investor mindset.
Psychology again.
Realizing your discipline, your rational decision-making, is just as important as the analysis. Treating it like a business, cutting losses, letting profits run, those are huge mental shifts.
Definitely. Cultivating that mindset, discipline, patience, process over outcome, that is a key differentiator between long-term success and struggle in the markets.
So for you listening, maybe think about how these ideas could fit into your own approach. Perhaps explore fundamentals or technicals a bit more. Or just revisit those bull and bear market phases to get a better feel for the big picture.
Continuous learning, refining your approach.
Exactly. It's all part of the journey.
And maybe a final thought to leave you with. Considering your own goals, your own comfort with risk, how could you realistically incorporate some of Nicholson's active risk management ideas? Maybe not his exact plan, but the principles. It's something worth pondering as you move forward.
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.